Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here at our kitchen table once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. Donna, did you see the eclipse? We went through an eclipse.
All right, I did not look at the sun.
Okay? Oh, bless you.
In any form. What I did was sit outside and kind of notice the changing colors of the shadows in the daylight. It got a little bit kind of rosy, orangey, mm-hmm. a little bit, but nothing terribly dramatic.
No. It was a little cloudy here in central Iowa, but I saw it because the clouds got out of the way for a bit, and we all can say that we went. I was so hoping that this eclipse, everybody would look up and realize how small we are on this planet, and why can't we get along? But I don't know if that helped at all.
Oh,
Donna.
I'm afraid that, our level of drama that we're used to in our culture has made these really natural inclinations too subtle for most of us,
That's too bad.
But I mean, it was lovely.
It was a nice eclipse.
It was not cataclysmic, okay?
No, we didn't have to, sacrifice anything or burn virgins.
And the world did not end.
And here we are again to talk about food. Here we are. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, Donna's going to give us some information about milk. And we're going to.
And dairy products.
And dairy products. And we dip into the Donalana Kitchen archives for a talk with Mark Rasmussen about what cows eat. But first, Donna and I explored some Iowa food products and Iowa food producers. There was an event last weekend in Waterloo, Iowa, sponsored by Silos and Smokestacks organization here in Iowa, and it was a big food expo, the Iowa Eats Food and Drinks Festival. We went because, Donna, believe it or not, they asked us to do a presentation
on cooking with lard.
One of our favorite subjects.
Absolutely.
So I packed up my rolling pin and...
Yeah,
and
Lana made a rustic tart.
And we made a tart, yeah. Huh?
She's a fine tart maker, so...
So I made a mess while Donna talked, and it was people. There were a lot of wonderful presenters, and we met old friends there. We met some new friends. There were kitchen demonstrations. There were drink demonstrations, and there were lots of bourbon.
Lots of beer, some cider.
Meat demonstrations, all kinds of stuff. And yes, the vendor area, the huge, I was kind of surprised.
Yeah, if you just kind of look around the room and graze a bit, you come away with the impression that what we do best in Iowa is pork and alcohol.
There were kind of a lot of those, yes. And they were giving alcohol samples. There was cider. There was beer.
Lots of bourbon.
Oh, my. Yep. Well, it's not. People are getting creative. All mm-hmm. sorts of stuff going on. There was Meskwaki fry bread there. There were people that were selling all kinds of meat and meat products. Early morning harvest was there.
Our favorite Iowa flowers. Flours.
Flours, yes. And, let's see. Farm Story meats were there. So you could either sample yourself silly, or they had things to sell there, too. And we have to take our hats off to the Silos and Smokestacks folks for putting this event together. I guess it was the second annual
and
event.
It was quite well attended. I was surprised.
It was very good.
My favorite surprise at the show was, and I don't know, these people hadn't heard of them. They must not really sell in our part of the state. It's called Country View Dairy. Where is it? Made in Hawkeye, Iowa. So they mostly sell yogurt, farm fresh yogurt, as they say. It was delicious. But what really surprised me, they were sampling their ice creams. But it tastes like ice cream, but it is actually frozen yogurt. And it is really was the best frozen yogurt I think I've ever tasted. The flavorings were really nice, but what was particularly good, obviously the quality of their milk makes great yogurt. But I asked him how he got that mouthfeel that you get from ice cream. He said he upped the fat percentage to 9%, which is the low end of the percentages for ice cream, but well within range and much higher than a usual frozen yogurt. He said, like, for example, they formulate their school yogurts because they have to meet certain, you know, federal fat and, you know, restrictions and stuff like that. They formulate their school yogurt tubs at 2%, but for this ice cream, they go up to 9%, which makes it less fat than regular ice cream, but really you don't feel that way when you're eating it. It was really, really delicious. Farm Country View Dairy. If you have that around, you go and try some. It was really, really good. Their yogurt is non-homogenized cream top and all natural. So anyway, that was a very pleasant surprise.
Yes.
Me and my love of all things ice cream.
And me and my love of all things cheese. So many people
there were a few nice cheeses that I didn't know we had, too. Yeah.
It was good. And cheese curds. Oh, you can't beat a good cheese curd. So there you go. So that was very good yogurt. And this Country View Dairy also had chocolate milk for a little sample. And it was not just like a shot of chocolate. It was tasty chocolate milk.
Yeah, it was well flavored.
The owner that was there, the person representing, and she said, "Well, we tried selling milk and funny about things, but you can't really make a whole lot of money just putting milk on the milk market." So they said, let's specialize.
It's pretty screwed up, yeah.
Another good example of a local family farm figuring out how to do something a little
some
special.
Some value-added products. Very, mm-hmm. really good. And it was a nice event. So, and our lard demonstration was well received. One of the people afterwards told me, "Thank you so much for helping me to understand that eating lard is not unhealthy." I mean, that, you know, certainly lard, eating too much of any fat is going to, you know, like, put the pounds on, you know. But the qualities of the fats that you eat are really, really important. And actually, lard, from many, multiple perspectives, is far healthier than, like, corn oil or, sorry, mazola or most of the vegetable oils.
Crisco.
Yeah, certainly than Crisco, too. It's, you know, I stick to, personally, olive oil, lard, butter for the appropriate applications. That's pretty much all I use.
Oh, and we found at this event there was a person called the Iowa Pie Lady, and she makes pies in quantity and sells them, and we were happy to find out.
Right. We were at her booth, and I thought, okay, you know, this was before the lard demonstration, so I thought, yeah, let's just see what she uses in her pie crust things. Lard! Lana and I were so pleasantly surprised.
100% lard. And she said, oh yes, I buy, and she must make a lot of pies. She said she buys lard in 50-pound blocks, which sort of set me back for a while. So more power to her.
She must have a decent amount of freezer refrigeration space, I guess, right?
The Iowa Pie Lady. That was the Iowa Eats Food and Drinks Festival in Waterloo. So talk more about the dairy products, because I certainly enjoyed grazing on the dairy products, and I do like cheese and milk and things, all kinds
of
things.
Well, there's, you know, first of all, the news almost every day is talking about how now avian, which is bird flu, and has been really disastrous in the poultry industry, and notably in Iowa, has been found in cows, not in Iowa, some in Texas and things like that. Not a lot of cows, but a few enough to be concerning, because it means that virus has, you know, is jumping across the, you know, the into mammals. Now, it's not the first time. They have found bird flu in, I think a polar bear somewhere in the polar areas and a fox somewhere else. So it's not like the first time, but there doesn't seem to be a panic about it. It has even spread to a couple of humans. I think the worst symptoms were like pink eye or something. So it's not that communicable for humans, although not impossible. It's certainly something that they're keeping their eyes on. But the good news for dairy farmers is that even with this outbreak, the price for dairy products has not fluctuated much. So there's no panic about the health of dairy products. So, dairy products. It all starts with milk from the cow. And then, of course, that is separated into milk and cream. And, you know, when you're looking at the dairy case, and in most grocery stores, it's a huge thing. There are lots of kinds. We're not just talking brands, although, of course, there are multiple brands of milk. But there's also different kinds of milk. In Iowa, in the store, everything is pasteurized, so that's a moot point. However, there are two kinds of pasteurization. There is called short high temp pasteurization or long lower temper pasteurization. Now, a lot of the milk in the stores, it says UTH on it, which means it was pasteurized at very high temperature, and it gives it a much longer refrigerated shelf life, which is why a lot of companies do it. I personally find that the milk, which is most of the milk these days, but not all of the milk, is processed that way for obvious reasons of convenience to the distributors in the stores and things like that. However, I find the milk tastes a little bit more cooked. If you ever have an opportunity to have just, you know, and make sure you're doing like whole milk or 2%, 2%. Get the same kinds of milk, one high temp pasteurized and the other one just regular pasteurized, and you'll see a slight flavor difference. So that's, you know, I grew up in a dairy family and I love dairy. So I want my milk to taste just like it used to.
Like the cow. As a kid, did you get to drink milk just straight from the cow?
Yes. Definitely. My uncles were dairy farmers, and, we drank the milk right off the farm. My father was in the processing industry, so, you know, he would take us into the plant as kids, and we'd, like, eat the cheese curds and fish the milk out of, you know what I mean? Some people can have developed a palate for wine. I have developed a palate for milk. I love milk.
It takes all kinds, Donna. Good for you.
Then homogenization is another process. Pasteurization is mainly to kill any bacterial things, contaminants that have gotten from the cow through the milk lines into the final product. So the next thing that they do to milk is they homogenize it, which is, so milk has the what we think of milk, and then the higher fat content, which is the cream, which will naturally rise to the top of the milk. So a good amount of the cream or butter fat, as it's called, will be skimmed off to be made into butter and cream and things like that. And the rest of the milk, then will have varying fat contents depending on, you know, there's whole milk, which is around 5% or so. These are all regulated terms. Then there's 2% fat milk. Then there's skim milk. So those three, it's cut down into those. And then cream also has varying fat contents. There's light cream and heavy whipping cream up to, I think, 86% fat, maybe, or is that butter? I've forgotten.
Oh, well, that's butter. I mean, pretty solid. Butter's about...
Highest is...
It's the 80, highest, 80-something.
Right. Yeah. European butter, if it says that on the package, it means it's a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. So homogenization is when they take the rest of the milk after they've taken the cream that they want to use for something else, and they force the fat globules through some sort of screen that makes them so small that they stay emulsified in the milk, right?
Ha!
So then again, you can buy what are called cream top like the Kelowna milk has a cream top. Mm-hmm. That means it has not been homogenized, and either you have to shake it up or else you'll have a little pat of butter on the top of mm-hmm. your milk. Now, me, I like it that way, of course.
I do too.
Yeah, but my grandson won't touch the, oh, I don't like those lumps in there or anywhere. You know, so I could never get him to drink what I call the good stuff. Anyway, so that's homogenization. Things that you need to know, like when you're getting into cheese, the French have done a lot of research on this. They call it the terroir in cheese, and they have a whole national system of, it's called AOC, Appellation Contrôlée, means where it comes from, and the name you put on the package is tightly regulated to be strictly in geographic sense as appropriate. For example, different kinds of cheese can only be called like a Camembert or a Brie. It has to be from certain areas. If it says it's from that area, it's from that area. And the reason they do this, and they have claimed this a long time, it's like grapes, that the qualities of the earth, the terroir, also especially for cows, the things that grow there, the forages that the cows eat, no big surprise, affect the flavor of the milk. If you have ever had, like in the spring, my uncle used to say when the garlic would come up, the cows would eat it and it would taint the flavor of the milk. And they were, you know, that was not a good thing for them. But, you know, it of course, I love garlic. I probably didn't even mind.
Now,
but,
nowadays, it would be a special terroir. We'd
sell right, garlic separate, milk,
but,
right?
Yeah. No, but it's true.
Yeah, so it seems also that depending on what the cows are eating, there will have higher nutritional value in some grasses and places, you know, where they will, like you can see the famous examples, well, for eggs too. When the chickens and the cows have access to a lot of fresh green pasture, the milk, the butter and the egg yolks both will have a deeper kind of orangey flavor. So, I mean, you eat a lot of orange cheeses these days, and most of the time it's because they've added some kind of coloring to it. But the association is from the rich grasses and the yellows that you get from the carotenoids in the grasses. So
that's true. Ever wonder why we think, yellow, butter should be yellow.
Yeah, creamy and, yellow.
Whoa, but it starts out as milk, so okay. They do add things every now and then. Kind of be aware of that. Good.
Well, there's been, especially in France, some of this work on terroir has been going on long enough that they have now are able to say that even certain forages that they feed cattle, kinds of grasses and stuff, can actually even affect the nutritional value of the food. So, you know, as we're exploring more and more the old-fashioned way of grass-feeding your cows and your beef and your lamb, and we didn't even mention sheep's milk, goat milk. There's no pig milk. Ha ha.
Ha ha. Well, there could be, but I'm not about
that. Nobody wants to milk the pigs, right? No. And these milks all have slightly different, certainly flavor profiles, different nutritional values, some limited, and also flavor.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with goat. It's always been known, whatever the goat eats, you can immediately tell from the, I think it's true of all of the animals, but, you know, goats are small and fast with quick turnaround, but.
Quick, spell terroir.
T-E-R-R-O-I-R.
Doesn't that mean like the earth is it?
Sort of.
It's
the land.
The land.
The
okay.
land, basically. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I've run across that term, like you mentioned, for grapes and wine.
Right, we've used so much that it's almost an English word at this point. The French would not like that, but it is. So
that's good.
Yeah,
and there's all kinds of things you can do with milk. It's so good.
We didn't talk about there are people who are actually, as adults, cannot drink milk, and they're called lactose intolerant. However, that doesn't mean they can't eat dairy products, because if you're having a cultured dairy product, which is yogurts, cheeses, all of those things, the bacterial culturing animal, beast, whatever it is, microbe, digests the lactose sugars in the milk, and that's what gives lactose intolerance. So even if you are lactose intolerant and don't drink milk anymore, you can still have cheese and yogurt.
Yes,
because and frozen yogurt.
Yeah. Sure, yogurt, because yogurt has been Donna sent me a news article recently from the Food and Environment Reporting Network called the Milk Drinking Cult. I knew this before, but I didn't know all the facts and figures here. There's a whole lot of people on our planet that cannot digest milk.
As adults.
As adults. Because we're mammals. We're mammals. A lot of us grow up with mother's milk. So, but lactose intolerant has been, not just a latest thing. Most of the world does not drink milk, raw milk. I mean,
right, the
raw milk.
And for good reason, because culturally, you know, refrigeration is a fairly recent invention. So culturing your milk will make it last longer. Like yogurt sitting in the refrigerator will stay edible much longer than a bottle of milk. So culturing dairy products, cheeses can last even longer. Mm-hmm. So culturing dairy products was a preservation method, and it made it also more digestible.
Come to find out, the reason Northern Europeans and up into Great Britain, somehow, during our evolutionary process of
a long time ago,
we kept our ability to drink milk. Okay, but much of the other world doesn't. Like Donna mentioned, especially Eastern Europe and the Middle East, they learn to cultivate or ferment mm-hmm. milk. However, the milk drinking cult that is referred to in this article is the fact that, along with everything else, Northern European, we tried to foist it on the rest of the world.
Right.
The dairy producing countries, well, in the United States now, and Northern Europe, milk is the most perfect food. Milk is the best for babies. And it just is not so. If you're dealing with your stomach that is not ready for that. So it has been part of a cultural push that milk is somehow important. And
part of our past colonial history, I'm
afraid. Yeah, there you go. Milk imperialism. It is a milk myth that, you know, just because we can drink a lot of this stuff does not mean other folks can. It's estimated that 60% of the world population lacks the gene of lactase persistence.
Lactase persistence means you can go ahead throughout your life mm-hmm. persistently eating milk, drinking mm-hmm. milk.
Yeah, so it's not really, milk is kind of a white folks thing. So it is. And because of the...
But cheese and yogurt are okay for everybody. Right?
So remember that. Remember that. Not everybody likes a big glass of milk like I do. So you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, and this is Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That tune is called Behind the Haystack by the Barn Owl Band. Little rural connection there, yes. We're talking about cows and milk and milk products.
Well, we should one of the most delightful things you'll see in the news some point with early spring is in cultures where they have, you know, no pasture in the winter, the cows are usually in the barn being fed hay and silage and things like that. And when the weather starts to come enough that they can see that green grass over the fence and the farmer turns them loose, you see the pictures of them frolicking. These big old animals like leaping and jumping around with joy for getting back into the pasture. Does that tell you that cows love grass?
Ah, spring. Oh, yes, very good. Well, cows are amazing things, and milk is an amazing thing, and cows and other ruminants, too, can turn grass into milk. That's an amazing thing. Now, the human stomach doesn't digest plant fibers and cellulose and all the stuff.
We don't do well on grass.
No, so we have the ruminants do it for us. There's been some studies about a microbe that is important to break down cellulose, and it's found in cow stomachs, and it used to be, believe it or not, in species, they samples of hunter-gatherers from 2,000 years ago. How do they get this? But you know, people are doing studies on ancient people, and they found that this genus Ruminococcus, the thing that digests plant fibers, used to be very prevalent in humans 2,000 years ago, but we've sort of lost that.
Okay, so we used to eat grass.
Yeah.
More grasses.
We could digest stuff. And now just something called ruminants. The cows do it for us. We've lost our ability to digest the roughage of plants. Yeah. Okay. But so, how do cows do it? We're going to dip into the archives here from a show from the Donna Lana Kitchen, actually back in August of 2015. We talked to Dr. Mark Rasmussen. He was the director of the Aldo Leopold Center on the ISU campus. Can anyone remember the Aldo Leopold Center on campus? It is no longer with us.
Well, it's sort of functioning.
Sort of with us, but not like it was. Anyway, he knows a lot about what is on the inside of cows, and he's going to help
us. He's a microbiologist, right?
Right. It's good. Let's hear what he has to say.
Today, our guest is Dr. Mark Rasmussen. He is a microbiologist, as he says. What did you say, Mark?
As opposed to a large biologist.
We
tend to think small.
He's here to talk about the microbiome. You want to give us a definition of that word?
Yeah, the microbiome is a big picture view of the microbes that we live with on our body, in our body. And people are looking at this in all kinds of habitats, all kinds of animals, soil, forests. Now with new sequencing technology, we can take these big picture views that we used to didn't have the techniques to do that.
I wonder why, because you see the word, the phrase microbiome, it's almost everywhere. And I was thinking of the human microbiome, and it's actually microbiome is bigger than the intestinal flora and fauna that we've been talking about for years.
Oh yeah, that would be considered to be the gut microbiome.
So he'd written this article. It's called Greening Up What We Eat. Basically, I'm going to just summarize it. It struck me as he's writing about cows here, but it struck me as a further admonition. And you do say this of eat your vegetables.
That's how I end the article, yeah.
Right.
As Grandma used to tell me, you know?
Exactly.
You know, in addition to the nutritional and fiber content that we learned about, you know, some time
ago. Roughage.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's important.
It has its limits. I mean, you know, all kale all the time is probably not what you want, but, you know.
I don't know. There are people who swear by that as their medicine, you know.
But we're learning other benefits of a diversified diet, basically, in animals and in humans, too.
Well, you talk here about that cattle are fed a standardized and simplified rations. And so what is that, and then what happens to them?
Well, there what I'm referring to is the cattle in their final feedlot stage, you know, 120 days or 140 mm-hmm. days, something like that, where...
And they've been on usually on pasture before that, or on grass anyway.
Yeah, I mean, our basically in talking to some other folks in that know ranching and in animal science, our cattle system, even with our feedlot system, about 70% of the process is still forages and hay and roughage, things like that, because the brood cows are out there all the time mm-hmm. on forages of some type, you know, winter, summer, summer grazing. And the calves are for the first part of their life when they're first born and then when they're weaned and they're still on pasture during that first summer. So, yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that the American consumer has gotten used to white fat on their meat.
And well-marbled.
Grass-fed cattle have a more yellowish appearance to, and of course most people, if they'd see that in a package at the grocery store, they'd go, ooh, what's wrong with that piece of meat? You know, is it aged or has it been on the shelf too long or whatever?
No, it has higher ratios of which kind of fatty acids?
Well, it's various compounds in the forage material, the carotenes that give their fat soluble, and so they end up in the fat. And so
the yellow fat is actually much healthier for you, isn't it?
Oh, but the perception is that when people look at it, they see it as an age indicator or a shelf life indicator. And so we're very used to having this bright white fat in our meat case. I can remember on my grandpa's farm, I'd go up there as a kid, and we'd take these ears of corn and snap them over the edge of the feed bunk, which would pop them in two, you know, or in thirds or something. And then a cow would pick that up, and they just kind of roll it around in their mouth and shell the kernels off of the cob, you know. So, yeah, corn has been fed to cattle for a long time. It's just a cattle have been fed different protein sources over the years, depending on pricing. Cottonseed cake was a popular one to feed cows in the winter. So, in other words, they'd take the cotton off for fabric production, mm-hmm. but then you'd have these seeds.
And they're oily, too, aren't they?
Well, they're oily, but they have protein in them, and, mm-hmm. and they do have some. They have a compound called gossypol in. And we can't tolerate very much of it. Cattle can tolerate a larger dose of that, and so they
Sorry,
can...
Sorry, tolerate does not sound good to me.
Well, because...
I mean, they can have eat this, something and the best doesn't make them sick.
That's what's so great about ruminants is they can tolerate plant toxins, natural plant toxins, to degrees that we cannot, because they have this whole big fermentation vat called the rumen up front.
And how many stomachs do they have?
Well, it's called four. They have the reticulum, the rumen, the abomasum, and the omasum, and each have a different function. But the rumen is by far the largest. You know, it can be 50 gallons or something.
So their microbiome in the intestines and digestive tract must be fairly interesting.
Oh, it is. I mean, I spent many, many years, you know, pulling microbes out of this environment and trying to figure out what they do.
Did you ever see one of those cows where they took the side out and put the window in?
Yep. We had some of those. Those are called fistulated animals.
Fistulated animals.
We learned this from – actually, physicians first learned this from gunshot wounds. Some people would have a wound to their stomach or their intestine, and it wouldn't heal up properly, so they'd have this opening. And so innovative physicians were trying to learn about the digestive process. So they would hang little pieces of meat on string or something in somebody's stomach and watch how fast it would disappear, you know, and things like that.
This
is getting into the strange realm.
Well, and this is happening at noon, so just kind of, you know, this is important science stuff. Sorry about that, folks. Oh, that's really interesting, though. I mean, just think of everything that's going on inside of us. And how cows work is always really, really interesting because they can convert, like you said, roughage, grass, carbon stuff.
Turn grass into milk. Now, that sounds like a miracle to me.
A miracle. Yeah. And they're big animals. They're big animals.
But yet there are ruminant species in Africa that are very small, maybe only a foot tall. Ruminants are very versatile. I mean, you've got very small ones that live in forests and live mostly on fruits. So they live on a very rich diet of sugars and things like that in fruit. And then you've got the browsers, which are deer or giraffe, which live on leaves from brush and shrubs and trees.
How many stomachs do they have?
These are all the same. They all have the basic four. Although it's pretty simplified in the fruit eaters because it doesn't take as elaborate a system.
Go through really fast, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the far extreme, you've got water buffalo that eat a very coarse forage diet, even more so than bison and cattle, which are kind of in the middle as grass grazers. So you've got this whole continuum and extreme examples.
So your research that you write about in this paper talks about how you feed the least expensive ration?
Well, as nutritionists, we're all taught to calculate rations based on least cost. So you look at, especially for ruminants, cattle, and sheep, you can use a whole range of feedstuffs, whatever's available. And of course, when you're looking at it from an economic standpoint, you're trying to fulfill their nutrient requirements, but do it in the lowest cost possible.
So is the dominant feed right now, is it corn and soy?
Mm-hmm.
And that's
and distillers grains, which has come on strong in the last 10 years because there's an abundant supply of it. And it has a very large content of protein because of the yeast that has come out of the ethanol fermentation process.
And what grains are the distillers? They're still corn and corn?
Well, predominantly it's corn.
So it's just more corn?
Well, it's what's left of the corn. The starch is gone. Oftentimes plants are now separating the oil out because they're turning that into biodiesel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what's left is the corn kernel fiber and a whole lot of yeast bodies, you know, yeast biomass. So it's a lot of protein.
So is the yeast biomass a good thing or nutritionally not a good thing? Or is there just too much of it?
I think it's just a case we've got an awful lot of it to use.
Well, you talk about, what are those pumps?
Oh, efflux pumps.
Efflux pump inhibitors.
Well, efflux just means going out, mm-hmm. you know. So I try to use the comparison of a bilge pump in a ship where you're trying to get things out of the hold of a ship if water leaks in or whatever. And so in the last 10 years at least, microbiologists have been studying these things. There's all kinds of them in terms of different classes of efflux pumps in different
species. And this applies to cows and humans, right? We have efflux pump inhibitors in our...
Well, yeah. I mean, in the clinical world, people are trying to look for synthetic drugs that they can use to help control antibiotic resistance by blocking these pumps because these bacteria use these pumps to get rid of nasty things that might harm them. So if an antibiotic is getting into their cell, they try and use the pump to pump it back out so it doesn't before it does its damage. And so the rationale in the clinical world is to come up with effective drugs which will block these pumps, and then the bacteria can't repair itself or can't protect itself if its pumps are not operating. So it gets around the problem of antibiotic resistance in some
of
our...
But in the meantime, you might be doing yourself some other disservice, right, with them?
Well, you know, with drug development, there's always the potential for side effects. So, you know, these things would have to be tested for toxicology, and they'd have to be tested with dose response for individuals and sensitive individuals. And, you know, that just comes with the development of any medicine for human use.
Well, because in the article you're saying that we need more of those to keep ourselves healthy.
Well, but the ones I'm talking about are naturally in the plant world.
Ah,
so in
big
all,
phrase, naturally in the plant world.
Yeah, as opposed to those that drug companies are trying to develop. I mean, they've looked at plants, too, as a first starter to give them some ideas mm-hmm. about maybe some compounds that they could synthesize specially that would be really potent. But that's a medicine. Here we're talking more nutrition and just what's out there in all kinds of plant. You know, think of any, you know, not just green. We put green in the title of this article, but, you know, think of your reds and your yellows and all kinds of things that show up in fruits and vegetables. So when we consume a diverse diet, not just potato chips or something, we get all kinds of compounds from the natural world in our diet. Now, you know, some of these things are known to be toxic, but we can tolerate certain doses. But others
so this
have
is,
these.
This is all used. The flavonoids are.
Yeah.
Are effects pump inhibitors?
Well, some of them. I mean, it depends. That's part of the research is that people are looking at different categories of natural plant compounds to see if they work. And it may depend on the species of microbe and the type of efflux pump that they have. Some work in some bugs and others don't work in those same bugs.
Which is why you need a variety, right?
Yeah, yeah. So if you have a variety, you're covering all bases.
We've been talking about efflux pump inhibitors, so stick around and find out some more.
What I'm trying to understand, Mark, is that the efflux pump inhibitors, which you write about, are somewhat lacking in what we're feeding animals today. And I would extrapolate that they may be lacking in our diets as well. Do you think this is a good summary of what you're talking about?
Yeah, that was basically the key message I was trying to get mm-hmm. across, that because we have so much corn and soy in a state like Iowa, they are the cheapest and most available ingredients around, and so animals do well on them. But there are unanticipated microbiological effects that we are learning about.
And what are those?
Well, for example, the USDA lab in Clay Center, Nebraska, has studied the feeding of high levels of distillers grains to cattle as being a contributing factor to the E. coli 0157 colonization in
Aha!
cattle.
That is a danger to human beings, for sure.
Well, been called, you know, the hamburger bug. You know, back from back in the 90s when it first started showing up in undercooked hamburger and harming individuals. And
so that's a result of what they've been having in that they've not had, you think, not quite enough greens, basically.
Well, I'm not saying it's the only factor. We don't know for sure where this...
Contributing factor.
It's a contributing factor. But most people don't feed 40% distillers grains to cattle either. That's a really very high level. Usually it's 10 or 15 or 20%. It's what economics does to our livestock system when we push and push for high productivity at the lowest possible cost.
But the basic thing is that the efflux pump inhibitors contribute to stronger intestinal better immunity.
We call it gut health.
Gut health.
Just
there
like
we go.
Soil health.
Just
gut health.
Just what we
need.
We all need gut health.
You know, it's immunity. It's happy bugs. It's the right bugs that keep you regular mm-hmm. and keep you in good health. It's the right nutrition. It's the whole big picture view of what goes on inside of you.
And these efflux pump inhibitors come from naturally occurring compounds found in plants that we eat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if we and the animals that we eat also get more greens and kind of vegetable-y foods.
Well, and it's no different than what nutritionists have been advising people to do for decades, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Eat your vegetables, eat more fruits. I mean...
I did recently read that 50% of all adult eating occasions are now officially snack food, which... unless you're eating an apple or a bunch of kale or some carrots, and that doesn't spring to my mind as mostly snack food. I think people are grabbing a yogurt or eating potato chips or...
Yeah, I wonder what they count as a snack food. You know, is it something you can eat one-handed while you're driving or,
yeah,
you know, what?
Or at the desk in front of... But we are growing numbers of people are eating more and more snacks and less real food and meals. So perhaps we're just mirroring what our cattle are getting. They're just... So Mark recommends that, like your grandmother said, eat your vegetables.
And the smarter we are about our food, maybe we'll be a little healthier. At least think about that before we eat it.
Come back to the old thing, variety is the spice of life.
And yeah.
That certainly applies to what you eat.
Yeah. That was a interview with Dr. Mark Rasmussen. This is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. So...
What year did you say we did that?
2015. We've been at this a while.
So 9 years ago, and it's still, I mean, I remember having Mark on the show, but I don't remember the details. And I'm thinking, boy, this is just as relevant, if not more so, than it was 9 years ago.
Yes, because, we started out talking about milk, right? And milk comes from cows and other ruminants, too. The wonderful process.
What the cows eat is really important.
What the cows eat is really important. I was interested in the, back 10 years ago, the use of distillers' grains was just, what a good idea. We got this. It's cheap. Let's feed it to the cows.
Yeah, we got to find some place to get rid of all that. Yeah. Right, because this is distillers' grains. It's not from distilling bourbon, let me tell you.
Oh?
It's from distilling ethanol.
Oh, that's something we have a whole lot of. Oh, dear. So cows are a little gassy then, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah, it's all those farts and burps that create the methane, and it's another greenhouse gas contributor.
Something else to blame on cattle.
I do want to just mention, the Strauss Dairy, which is out in California, they're old friends of mine, and so I read their newsletter all the time. And so Albert Strauss has been, for now several years, been feeding some kind of red seaweed to his cows, and it dairy cows, significantly reduces the amount of methane produced. So he's trying to make his dairy operation... which is a lot of Northern California dairies to make, you know, milk, cream, yogurt, da-da-da-da-da. He's trying to get a program so that the dairy business can be carbon neutral.
Huh.
And by golly, he's got his thinking cap on. He's doing some really good things. And one of it is to feed a small, very small percentage of the cow's diet to give them this seaweed. Which probably has some really good nutrients in it as well. It's good for the cows, and it makes them digest in a way that less methane is produced.
Ha!
Doo-doo-doo-doo.
Good. I wonder if it has something to do with, as Dr. Rasmussen talked about, the efflux pump inhibitors bacteria thing. I didn't quite get that, but it's a good word, efflux pump inhibitors.
Well, it is plant things that do that. He mentioned... what did he mention? Biflavonoids, which are kind of like parts of vitamin C or something.
Ah, very good. Very good. Well, as I mentioned, we kind of got into this milk thing by tasting some really good yogurt at the Iowa Food Festival that we went to in Waterloo this past weekend, and we had a good time giving our demonstration. There were all sorts of demonstrators there and classes you could take.
Demonstrators. Right. No, not that kind. The kind of people demonstrating showing their product. Okay.
That's it.
Not political demonstrators.
No. What? Everything is political, Donna. It's good.
Boy, I'll say.
It was fun to run into people that we've known, other producers and whatever. One of the, there was an event space or a event room there called the Meat Locker. And believe it or not, they had a whole lineup of things that people were really interested in. Beef breakdown, how to cut up a chicken. That was given by John Hoagland. One chicken, five meals, butchering the whole chicken. And it was well attended.
And we're going to try to have John and his wife, Beth Hoffman, Whippoorwill Farm, on the show soon to talk about these things. They are lots of fun.
Lots of fun. And some of these things you just have to see. So it was nice to go and see.
Sausage making. John did sausage making.
Yes.
With plenty of tasting.
Yes, and barbecue sauce, of course. When we first drove up to the event center there in Waterloo, at the main door that we were supposed to go in, there were two fire trucks sitting there. I said, oh, this day is not going to go well if the fire department is already there. But come to find out, they were there as kind of a showcase, because part of the event was a fireman's cook-off. So it was a big deal there. There were
like the challenge cooking you see on television with all local firemen.
A
judge, the whole bit.
It happened kind of the same time we were giving our presentation, so I didn't go to it.
I guess the assumption is firemen know how to play with fire?
I guess. Or maybe firemen know how to cook. The stories about... I don't know if they still do. In the olden, people lived in the firehouse, or at least the firemen had to be available, and so they'd cook meals there. So there you go.
Well, you don't want a hungry fireman, right?
Ha! Good. Oh, another thing, the Silos and Smokestacks organization that organized this do a lot of Iowa history things, and I ran across a booth there. A woman was making something called Johnny Cake and giving away recipes. And it kind of reminds us how simple cooking can be. And you hear Johnny Cakes. This is the kind of thing that if you were tramping across the open prairie, you could cook this on a rock if you had to. But or you had cooked on a shovel if you had to.
Okay, it have to be pretty hot rock. Hot rock, right?
Okay. You might want to take
primitive
a frying
cooking
pan.
Skills we're talking about.
Yeah, you might want to. And I was surprised at how good this was. The ingredients are 1 cup cornmeal, 1/2 cup of dry milk. Now, I don't know what is historically accurate about dry milk. But anyway, this...
That might not be the historical. That might be the current backpack camper's method.
Ah, that would work, too. 1/2 cup dry milk, 1 cup boiling water, and a pinch of salt. Stir ingredients together and drop by the spoonful onto a hot skillet. We're talking kind of a loose, corny, mealy pancake. I was surprised at how tasty it was. I mean, it wasn't just like...
Maybe they were using early morning harvest cornmeal.
Someplace they were getting something that tasted like something, because I was expecting survival food. It was a lot better than
that. It
was
survival food.
It was.
But that doesn't mean that survival food doesn't have to taste bad.
That's true. Anyway, we had a good time. Johnny Cake recipe. I want to mention, this past week, the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, ICCI, sponsored a Zoom meeting about water, and it was
water
really
quality
good.
In Iowa. You know, we got to remember, we're going on our third year. Hopefully it won't be so terrible. We are in a drought in Iowa. And water tables, particularly in some cities and towns, are dropping lower than anticipated. We'll just say that. Having enough water has become a civic problem in Iowa. And not just the quality of the water, but the quantity of the water.
We are living in interesting times.
Skunk River is running. It's still pretty low for the spring.
Pretty dry and dusty here, and water is an important thing. And that was a really good Zoom presentation. It featured Chris Jones and Carolyn Raffensperger as speakers. So good. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you Tuesdays at noon and repeat at 7 p.m., and we have a podcast, too.
Our podcast can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in Donalana, that's one word, Donalonna, second word, kitchen, and you will find us.
Good. Thanks for joining us today. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.